things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour. How's it going?
So good. How's it going for you?
It's going really good.
How was your week?
It was good. Very busy. Mm-hmm. I was in Detroit all week.
Yeah.
And I finished my very last training class.
Ooh.
Yeah. So
how do you feel?
I feel pretty good about it.
Feel trained?
Yeah. Well, it was my last class that I taught of new hires.
Oh.
So I graduated my last class before I move on to organizational development land. I have, I'm doing an observation of the girl that's taking my place.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be my last.
Hoorah with L&D.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is crazy. You've been in this position for a long time.
Yeah.
I remember when you were first offered this position.
Many moons ago.
Many moons ago.
Yeah. I was there for 3.5 years. I mean, I'm still with the same company, but moving on, keeping that momentum up, climbing the corporate ladder, man.
Uh-huh. We love a advantageous woman.
Yes.
So happy.
Yeah,
so happy for you.
Really excited. And we are finally, like, our team got just completely out of whack for a while. Like, two of us got new positions. One of us left. We added a service technician.
Mm-hmm. Into the fray.
Trainer into the fray. He's doing wonderfully. We just hired a new training manager. We have both of the other two spots filled.
That's a shuffling.
So we almost have a complete team. We have one more spot to fill.
Okay.
And we're hoping that they're going to be filled in the next 30 days.
Okay.
And then
it's
a whole team that I feel okay leaving.
Good.
Because there for a minute I was like, I'm going to be leaving with one person in place.
You can't walk away.
I feel like that's not going to work.
No, it's not. That poor soul.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was my week. Lots of moving, shuffling, getting our training centers together and getting ready to put a bow on it so I can leave.
Amazing. I'm so proud of you.
Yay, thank you.
You're doing the best. Doing the best and the most. Have you heard about this pastor who's creating a stir? Gregory Locke.
Uh-uh.
You haven't heard about this?
No, tell me.
So he's one of those evangelist, fire and brimstone.
Oh, is he one of the TV guys?
Not so well. He's getting a lot of publicity now,
okay,
because
fair.
He named women in his congregation as witches and is calling for witches to be burnt in the street.
What the fuck?
Yeah, he says that
No. The
American nation of Christ is under attack by Satan and his minions, witches, and says that America is in a spiritual crisis and these witches are everywhere and they are outnumbered. And I'm like, yes, you are, baby.
You are.
Yes, you are, baby.
Please sit down before you get yourself cursed.
Right. And he said that he was like, we have three, first and last names of women in our congregation who are witches. And he has this, I'm sure it'll come up on your TikTok now.
Sure.
He has this one clip of him preaching. He's talking to, he goes, you would not believe all the witches there are. There are Cracker Barrel witches, Waffle House witches, man witches. And I'm like, they're called warlocks, you fucking dummies.
You ding dong.
You ding dong.
I mean, I would be a Cracker Barrel witch.
I find myself more as a Waffle House witch. I'm more very chaotic to who I am.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
I'm like grandma.
Yes. Country fried steak.
Yeah.
And mashed potatoes.
Grandma Rosemary comes to see me. and gets her biscuits and gravy.
Yes.
In the morning with extra pepper.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
That is my aesthetic.
Your witch brand. Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. I feel like Waffle House.
You've got drunk people.
Oh, chaos. Chaos magic and waffles.
Your cook and your server are breaking up.
Love a Waffle House witch.
I like this for us.
I know.
You too. Let us know what your restaurant witch aesthetic is.
Now, listen, if we get a pick.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I still might be a Waffle House witch, even if I do get to choose. More of a arena, but specifically that night that there were like the two bridal parties fist fighting outside, yes, and we couldn't get into the bar. One, yeah, of those. An,
okay, arena witch. That's fair. I would like to say that I'm like a club soda witch.
Love. Dirty martini.
Yeah, that might be a stretch too in the sophisticated realm.
We might not exactly be there. Like Hoppy Gnome.
Oh, yeah.
Hoppy Gnome.
Yeah.
They got good tacos.
They do have good, they do have good tacos. Maybe like a Henry's.
Yeah. Listen, here's the thing. So few of our listeners are local.
Right. Nobody knows any of the places.
No, I do love a Henry's witch, though. I could also get, on my best of days, uh-huh, I would also like to identify as a Henry's witch. It's like a very, it's old. It's super old. Mm-hmm. It was actually the first underground gay bar in Fort, yeah, Wayne. And that's why they have two men's restrooms.
Yeah.
It's super original woodwork.
It's beautiful.
They make their Caesar salad dressing in-house.
It's so good.
It's so good. So if you guys are ever in Fort Wayne, you have to visit Henry's. It's like a historical landmark.
That's where we should do our first like meet and greet.
Oh my God. Okay.
I like it.
Okay. Let's go to the bars. Yeah.
Bar crawl.
Bar.
A little bit bar crawl.
Don't. Taylor, don't. Come on, girl. Ooh, my heart is racing.
Hold on, though. I like it.
Okay. If you guys want to do a little bit bar crawl where we just drag you to all of our favorite places in Fort Wayne,
let us know. Go ahead and we should do a poll.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Follow us on the Instagram.
Yeah.
Send us an email if you would like to come to Fort Wayne and hang out. We'll plan it. And then we'll just go do a little bar crawl.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should do it like in the spring.
Yes.
So we can like ride our little bicycles.
Fun.
Ah. I love this. We could go to haunted places because all downtown Fort Wayne is haunted. We go to the Scottish Rite.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Hold on. We're having a brain blast right here, right now. Okay. Let us know if you're interested in this.
It's got to be like a May or June.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fun. I could fuck around with a May.
I like it.
I like it too.
Okay. Word.
Okay. Great.
This is how all of Jenny and I's harebrained schemes are born. This very moment.
This is how the podcast started.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So.
Decisions are made very quickly around here.
We're ideas girls.
Yes. We're both ideas girls. Very not task girls.
Not task. You're very execution.
Yes.
I'm not. I'm just here for the ideas.
I like it.
Thanks. Let me contribute something.
I like it. Oh, man. Ooh, okay. Good. Are you going first today?
Yes. Ooh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
All right. Hold on. Let me get comfy.
Come on. Snuggle on in here. Gather around, children.
Gather around.
Okay, let me get, I don't know why this is like reading so stupid. There we go. Okay, I got it. You ready?
So proud.
Thank you.
Do you need to move the little poof over for your leg? You don't have to. I don't want
to put my, because my feet are sweaty still. Again, like I am still having clam feet.
From three weeks ago,
still with the clam feet. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So no, I'll leave them over here.
I mean, you,
I don't even want to put them on your carpet.
Homie, you cleaned up cat puke off my couch when you got here this morning. I don't think your clammy feet are going to bother me that much.
Fair. Okay. All right. I'll put myself in a perspective here.
Check yourself before you write yourself.
Lord have mercy. Okay. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready.
Okay. Francis Spletcher. Mm-hmm. Does that name sound familiar to you at all?
No.
Okay. She was a glowing and happy 17-year-old in 1921.
Aww.
The world was healing from the devastating war of land, sea, and air, the Great War it was being called. The workforce was light, as so many soldiers had perished in the open rolling fields of France. Some of their bodies and their various parts still laid there, never to come home again. It was a time of progress. Good had prevailed over evil, and societal restraints on women and how they lived their lives had not so much lightened, but there was some pushback from the women. We're having a little suffragette moment.
Okay.
In the early years of the Roaring Twenties, women were able to enter the workforce instead of marriage, a common choice for young women, a choice Frances made. She was soon offered a position at the Waterbury Watch Company in Connecticut. On her shift, Frances and her co-workers were responsible for painting the faces of a new popular watch model that was used during the war. She was paid 8 cents per dial, an amount that, for the time, was a very decent living for a young woman to make. It was an opportunity few got, and Frances knew her blessings. It's why, even after fainting spells caused by severe anemia and through severe toothache, she continued to work. However, her dental trouble soon got so severe that she sought treatment from a local dentist, who advised that she would need to have nearly all of her teeth pulled.
What?!
But when her dentist went to pull her first, the room was horrified when a sizable portion of her jawbone came with it. She continued to work even as her jaw and mouth rotted away.
What the fuck?
Soon, her jaw and cheek were no more than a gaping open wound. You could see through to the inside of her mouth. She had a slow, agonizing death, and Frances Spletzer passed away in 1925 at only 21 years old. She was the first of the Radium Girls to die, but was not the last.
Oh, shit. Oh. I just got full body goosebumps. I've heard of the Radium Girls, but I don't know much about them.
You're about to learn all about it.
That's why I'm here.
Here we are.
Teach me everything you know.
Marie Sklodowska was studying physics and mathematics in Sorbonne University in 1894 when she met Pierre Curie, who would later become her husband, Anton Marie Curie.
Ooh.
Pierre was a professor at the Paris School of Physics and Chemistry, and their mutual passion for the natural sciences drew them together. Pierre took on Marie as his doctoral student, and the two were intrigued by the work of fellow physicist Henri Becquerel, who had discovered in 1896 an invisible radiation emitted by uranium that caused photographic plates to darken after contact with uranium crystals. Becquerel's work became an inspiration for Marie's doctoral work, and the breakthrough moment for the Curies occurred 2 years later, when Marie was researching pitch-blende uranium ore from the, I'm so sorry, Joachimsthal mine in Poland, and noticed 2.5 times more radiation emitted from the ore than could be explained by the uranium content. She hypothesized that the pitch-blende contained another element, one more radioactive than uranium.
Okay.
After a lengthy isolation process, Marie obtained a radium chloride precipitate and coined the term radioactivity to describe radiation emitted from atomic decay. The groundbreaking subsequent work in radium isolation and purification ultimately granted Marie Pierre and Henri Becquerel the Nobel Prize in 1903.
Wow.
As radium grew in press and popularity, so did the industrialization and commercialization of radium, which was branded as a refreshing and vitalizing element for boosting health. Radium clinics and spas were established, and companies began selling radioactive dressings and pills in radium-infused chocolates and water to the public.
What? Oh my god.
In the medical community, doctors began to use early stages of radiotherapy for cancer patients, wherein a radiation beam could be focused on a tumor. When World War I swept over Europe and there was a demand for medical treatment on the battlefront, Marie Curie herself devised and built radiology cars from donated vans, trucks, and limousines, which were reconfigured to carry diagnostic radiology equipment, such as the first X-ray units and fluoroscopes, to the front lines.
Wow.
The Radium Girls, as we know them now, were the young women who were driven to the workforce following the war, and primarily all of the victims were Frances's peers. Bright young women who were advantageous and ready to do away with outdated turn-of-the-century societal gender norms. Before their slow and gruesome necrosis, they were almost revered. Wow. Beautiful young women working with the new miracle discovery. U.S. Radium Corporation, or USRC, hired approximately 70 women to perform various tasks, including handling radium, while the owners and the scientists familiar with the effects of radium carefully avoided any exposure to it themselves.
Interesting.
Chemists at the plant used lead screens, masks, and tongs, and USRC had distributed literature to the medical community describing the injurious effects of radium. In spite of this knowledge, a number of similar deaths had occurred by 1925, including the company's chief chemist, Dr. Edwin E. Lehman, and several female workers. The similar circumstances of their death prompted investigations by Dr. Harrison Martland, county physician of Newark. An estimated 4,000 workers were hired by corporations in the U.S. and Canada to paint watch faces with radium. At USRC, each of the painters mixed her own paint in a small crucible and then used camel hair brushes to apply the glowing paint onto dials, and so they would glow in the dark.
Okay.
The brushes would lose shape after a few strokes, so the USRC supervisors encouraged their workers to point the brushes with their lips, coining the term lip dip paint. Or use their tongues to keep them sharp. Because of the true nature of the radium had been kept from them, the radium girls painted their nails, teeth, buttons on their dresses, and faces for fun with the deadly paint produced at the factory. Many of the workers became sick, and among the first to see numerous problems among dial painters were dentists. Dental pain, loose teeth, lesions, ulcers, and the failure of tooth extractions to heal were some of these conditions. Many of the women later began to suffer from anemia, bone fractures, and necrosis of the jaw, a condition now known specifically as radium jaw.
Wow.
The women also suffered from suppressed menstruation and sterility. It is thought that the X-ray machines used by the medical investigators may have contributed to some of the sickened workers' ill health by subjecting them to additional radiation. It turned out at least one part of the examinations was a ruse, part of a campaign of disinformation started by the defense contractor. U.S. Radium and other watch dial companies rejected claims that the afflicted workers were suffering from exposure to radium. For some time, doctors, dentists, and researchers complied with requests from the companies not to release their data. In New Jersey, the story of the abuse perpetrated against the workers is distinguished from most such cases by the fact that the ensuing litigation was actually covered by the media.
Wow.
It never gained traction. That's anywhere crazy. Else. Plant worker Grace Fryer decided to sue, but it took 2 years for her to find a lawyer even willing to take on U.S. Radium. And even after the woman found a lawyer, the litigation process moved slowly. At their first appearance in court on January 1928, two women were bedridden and none of them could raise their arms to take the oath.
Wow.
A total of five factory workers, Grace Fryer, Edna Hussman, Catherine Schaub, and sisters Quinta McDonald and Albina Larice, dubbed the Grace Fryer, Edna Hussman, Catherine Schaub, and sisters Quinta McDonald and Albina Larice, dubbed the Radium Girls, joined the suit. In Illinois, employees began asking for compensation for their medical and dental bills as early as 1927, but were refused by management. The demand for money by sick and dying former employees continued into the mid-1930s.
Wow.
Before a suit before the Illinois Industrial Commission, IIC, was brought. In 1937, five women found an attorney by the name of Leonard Grossman that would represent them in front of the commission, but at this time, Radium Dial had closed and moved to New York. The IIC did retain a $10,000 deposit left by Radium Dial when it disclosed to the IIC that they could not find any insurance to cover the cost of indemnifying the company against employee suits. In the spring of 1938, the IIC ruled in favor of the women.
Yay!
The attorney representing the interests of Radium Dial appealed, hoping to get the verdict overturned. And again, Commission Judge George B. Marvel found for the women. Radium Dial appealed over and over, taking the case all the way to the Supreme Court.
Holy shit.
Mm-hmm. And on October 23rd, 1939, the court decided not to hear the appeal, and the lower court's ruling was upheld. In the end, this case had been won 8 times over before Radium Dial was finally held accountable. The Radium Girls' saga holds an important place in the history of both the field of health physics and labor rights movement. The right of individual workers to sue for damages from corporations due to labor abuse was established as a result of the Radium Girls case. In the wake of the case, industrial safety standards were demonstrably enhanced for many decades. This case, which was first settled in 1928, before the trial was deliberated by the jury, and the settlement for each of the Radium Girls was $10,000.
Okay.
Which is, in right now money, like $150,000.
Okay.
So, and then $600 per year annually until their eventual death, which is now $9,000. For all their lives while they lived, and all medical and legal expenses incurred would also be paid by the company. The lawsuit and resulting publicity was a factor in the establishment of occupational disease labor law. Radium dial painters were instructed in proper safety precautions and provided protective gear. In particular, they no longer shaped paintbrushes by lip and avoided ingesting or breathing the paint.
Good.
But radium paint was still used in dials as late as the 1970s.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You can still buy them. I Googled it.
Oh, wild.
Right. Unfortunately, many of the women did not live to ever see their day in court, as it were, as their bodies had rotted away and they were gently laid to rest. Their families didn't see a penny from the companies either, and all they had were the remains of their beloved daughters, sisters, and wives in glow-in-the-dark watch dials.
Wow.
And that is the story of the Radium Girls.
Holy shit. That's wild.
Gross, right?
That's so gross. Those poor sweet babies.
I know. And I would also like to point out the first line was Frances Fletcher was a glowing and happy 17-year-old 1921.
Literally glowing.
Glowing. Get it?
Literally glowing. Glow in the dark girl.
Glow in the dark girl.
Wow. Good job.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
That's a big one.
It's a important topic in understanding that, like, companies taking advantage of people is a pervasive and ongoing
issue
in America, in capitalist America.
Love it. So I have a disaster kind of around the same time.
Okay.
For you.
Okay.
I have a singular mingular source.
Okay.
Today.
Okay.
So this is...
Oh, I didn't give you my source.
Oh, okay.
Hold on.
Yep.
I would have been so mad if I forgot to do that. Okay. My sources are The Radium Girls, Living Dead Women, published March 19th, 2019 by Arlene Balkansky from the Library of Congress. The History of Radium by Elaine Louis, March 23rd, 2021, submitted as coursework at Stanford University. And The Secret Killer of the Waterbury Radium Girls from the New England Historical Society.
All right. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, you're fine. So this, what I'm about to read to you, is the entire article.
Okay.
That was written for the Smithsonian by Susan Stranahan.
The Smithsonian.
Yeah.
Okay, kiki.
So I am going to tell you about the USS Eastland disaster.
I've never even heard of that, but I love a good boat story.
You are going to freak out when I tell you this story.
Oh, I am?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we have been where this disaster has taken place.
We have?
Yes.
What?
It took place in the river in Chicago.
Ooh, gross. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. At 7:18 a.m. on July 24th, 1915, the crew of the Great Lakes excursion steamer Eastland prepared for that morning's journey and hauled its gangplank, forcing a tardy passenger to leap aboard from the wharf along the Chicago River.
I'm sorry, but I feel like gangplank is a bad word.
Listen, I don't have anything.
What is a gangplank?
I think it's the plank, it's the walkway that you walk up into a ship.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Gangplank.
Gangplank.
Now, okay. I learned a new vocab word.
Well, we've just made up a definition for it. We both agreed on
We're
it.
Probably
but, yeah.
wrong.
Somewhere somebody in the Navy is like, these girls are fucking dumb.
I know. It's my brother.
Oh. Luke.
Luke, Aaron, Jason.
Okay, go on. Sorry, God. I didn't mean to derail you.
Despite the cool, damp weather, 2,573 passengers and crew crowded aboard the Eastland, the atmosphere festive. The latecomer, E.W. Sladke, headed to the promenade deck to join co-workers from the Western Electric Company's Hawthorne Works factory in nearby Cicero. The Eastland was one of five vessels chartered to carry Western Electric workers and their families on a day-long outing from downtown Chicago to a park 38 miles across Lake Michigan to the southeast. More than 7,000 tickets had been sold.
Mm.
Among those aboard the Eastland were George Sendlier, a Western Electric foreman, and his wife and five children. James Novotny, a company cabinet maker, accompanied by his wife and their two children. Anna Quinn, 22, and her neighbor and fellow Western Electric clerk, Caroline Homolka, 16, had chosen their outfits carefully, for this was a social event, and for many of the young workers, not only a rare Saturday break in the manufacturing and assembling telephone equipment, but also an opportunity to meet other eligible singles. The Eastland was the first boat scheduled to leave, and employees had been encouraged to get there early. By a few minutes after 7 a.m., men, women, and children were boarding at the rate of 50 per minute, with two federal inspectors keeping careful count per normal practice.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. The Eastland was licensed to carry 2,500 passengers plus crew. As a steady drizzle began to fall, many of the women, especially those with young children, took refuge below deck. In the main cabin, a band played for dancing. On the upper deck, passengers jostled to find seats or leaned against the railing, calling out to arriving friends. As the Eastland filled with passengers between 7:10 and 7:15, it began to list to port, away from the wharf. The movement didn't seem to alarm the partygoers, but it caught the attention of the harbor master and some other observers on land. By the time Sladke made his last-minute leap, however, the 275-foot longboat had righted itself. If only briefly. At 7:23, it listed even farther to port. Water poured through the open gangways into the engine room. The crew there, realizing what was about to happen, scrambled up the ladder to the main deck.
Oh, God.
At 7:28 a.m., the Eastland listed to a 45-degree angle. The piano on the promenade deck rolled to the port wall, almost crushing two women. A refrigerator slid to port, pinning a woman beneath it. Water poured into the portholes in the cabins below deck. The most deadly shipwreck in Great Lakes history, a calamity that would take more passenger lives than the sinking of the Titanic or the Lusitania.
What is that?
I don't know. That's another disaster I'll have to look up.
Okay.
A calamity was underway.
Yeah. Status calamitous.
Bad. Few, if any, of the passengers boarding that day noticed that the Eastland carried a full complement of lifeboats, life rafts, and life preservers. It was in compliance with the law, and that created a serious hazard.
Oh.
In 1912, the sinking of the Titanic gave rise to Lifeboats for All movement among the international marine safety officials.
I'm sorry. What a terrible name.
I know. In the United States, Congress passed a bill requiring lifeboats to accommodate 75% of a vessel's passengers. And in March 1915, President Woodrow Wilson signed what became known as the La Follette's Seamen's Act. During the debate over the bill, the general manager of the Detroit and Cleveland Navigation Company had warned that some Great Lakes vessels with their shallow drafts would turn turtle if you attempted to navigate them with this additional weight on the upper decks.
Got it.
Too few legislators listened.
Well, they don't know how boats work.
Nope. By July 1915, the Eastland, which had been designed to carry 6 lifeboats, was carrying 11 lifeboats, 37 life rafts at about 1,100 pounds each, and enough jackets, about 6 pounds each, for all 2,500 passengers and crew. Most were stowed on the upper decks. No tests were conducted to determine how the additional weight affected the boat's stability, even though it already had a troubled history.
Wow.
So the Eastland was built in 1902 to carry 500 people for lake excursions and to haul produce from the return ships to Chicago.
Wait, and how many people were on this boat?
More than 2,500.
Holy. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
The boat had no keel, was top heavy, and relied on poorly designed ballast tanks in the hold to keep it upright. Repeated modifications increased the vessel's speed and passenger capacity and made it less stable. It was said of her that she behaved like a bicycle, being unstable when loading and unloading, but stable underway, wrote transportation historian and economist George W. Hilton, whose 1995 book, Eastland, The Legacy of the Titanic, provides a meticulous investigation. Safety inspectors focused only on the Eastland's performance while underway, and the boat routinely was certified as safe.
But not, like, the actual getting underway, though.
Right.
Yee. It's like how planes crash when they take off and land.
Yep.
Okay.
In July of 1904, the boat nearly capsized with 3,000 people on board.
Woo!
2 years later, it listed heavily with 2,500 passengers aboard. The Eastland soon developed a reputation as unsafe, a hoodoo boat in the slang of the day. The passengers appeared to recognize the potential dangers of the ship better than the management or the inspectors did, Hilton wrote. Indeed, an official of the St. Joseph Chicago Steamship Company, which bought the Eastland for $150,000 in 1914, testified that at a coroner's request, testified at a coroner's inquest a few days after the accident. I didn't know much about the boat except that we got it at a bargain. All I do is sign blank checks.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like you should probably put a little more effort
into signing your blank checks, my dude.
Right.
Critical to a boat's stability is what is known as a metacentric height. Floating objects are like an upside-down pendulum with the center of gravity and the ability to roll or heel to either side before righting itself. The distance between fully upright and the maximum heel, the point beyond which it will capsize, is its metacentric height. Referring to the Eastland, Hilton wrote, "For such a ship, where the distribution of passengers was highly variable, normal practice would have been to provide a metacentric height of 2 to 4 feet fully loaded. Changes made to the Eastland before July 24th had reduced its metacentric height to 4 inches.
Woof.
Not enough inches.
That is not even close to being enough inches, sir.
No.
Okay.
Times when men should be concerned about size.
You're done. But these men, like, 4 inches, that's about what, 3-4 feet?
That's like 4 feet. It's close enough. If you look correctly, it's actually 18 inches.
You're just catching a bad angle. Really? It's not the size of the boat, it's the motion of the ocean.
Oh, no.
Oh, God, okay. Sorry, we're 12.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Within 2 minutes after it listed 45 degrees to port, it rolled over, as a reporter Carl Sandburg wrote for the International Socialist Review, like a dead jungle monster shot through the heart. By 7:30 a.m., the Eastland was lying on its side in 20 feet of murky water, still tied to the dock. The vessel rolled so quickly, there was no time to launch the life-saving equipment. As the boat settled on its side, many passengers simply climbed over the starboard railing and walked across the exposed hull to safety, never even getting their feet wet. Sladkey was one of them. So was the Easton's captain, Harry Peterson. They were among the lucky ones. When the boat toppled on its side, those on the upper deck were hurled off like so many ants being brushed off of a table, wrote Harlan Babcock, a reporter for the Chicago Herald. In an instant, the surface of the water was black with struggling, crying, frightened, drowning humanity.
Ugh.
We infants floated about like corks.
Mm.
About 10,000 people were milling about the riverfront that day. Grocery and poultry merchants, their customers, Western Electric workers waiting to board other ships. Horrified onlookers raced to the rescue, some jumping into the river. According to one account, a man contemplating suicide at the river's edge jumped in and began saving lives.
Oh, that's a nice little tidbit.
I know. Others threw whatever they could grab to provide flotation for those struggling in the water, including boards, ladders, and wooden chicken crates. Some of the crates struck passengers in the water, knocking them out and putting them under. Just, it goes from, like,
bad to worse. I'm sorry, it's not fun.
Just donked them on the head. So bad.
Listen, if you cannot help, at least do no harm.
Right. Just tossing whatever they could into the water.
There's a mass of people drowning, and so you're throwing trash at them. Yeah. The heart was in the right place.
Yeah.
Okay.
Parents clutched children and disappeared together beneath the brown water, or lost their grip and watched their children sink out of sight. God, the screaming was terrible. It's ringing in my ears yet, a warehouse worker told a reporter. Helen Reppa, a Western Electric nurse on her way to the outing, heard the screaming from blocks away. The trolley she was riding came to a halt in traffic. When a mounted policeman told her an excursion boat had overturned, Reppa assumed it was one of the boats chartered for the picnic. Dressed in her nurse's uniform, she hopped into the rear step of a passing ambulance. People were struggling in the water, clustered so thickly that they covered the surface of the river, she would recall. The screaming was the most horrible of all. When she arrived at the riverfront, Repa scrambled onto the Eastland's hull and saw passengers being hauled out of the river and others being dragged through the portholes. Many were cut and bleeding. The injured were taken into a nearby hospital, which was quickly overwhelmed. Repa directed a hospital employee to telephone Marshall Field & Company, the department store, for 500 blankets. Then she called restaurants and asked for hot soup and coffee to be delivered to the hospital.
What a smart cookie!
She is a shining star.
Okay.
As survivors made it to the dock, Repa decided to send the less injured home. I would simply go out into the street, stop the first automobile that came along, load it up with people, and tell the owner or driver where to take them, she later wrote. Not one driver said no.
Oh.
By 8 a.m., almost all of the survivors had been pulled from the river. Then came the gruesome task of locating and removing bodies.
Ooh. God.
The crowding and confusion were terrible, Repa wrote. Rescuers, emergency personnel, and curious onlookers flocked to the scene. By noon, divers and rescue workers finally reached bodies that had been trapped underwater in the portside cabins. After that time, all the bodies came up seemed to be women and children. Seven priests arrived to hear confessions or administer last rites. There was little work for them, one reporter wrote. The results of the Eastland somersault could be phrased in two words. Living or dead.
Ooh, that gave me the chilly willies.
Yeah.
That was haunting. Okay.
Stretcher bearers traversed the hall as bodies were lifted out. I wondered dully why they waited for stretchers at all, wrote Gretchen Korn in the New York Times. All the bodies carried past were so rigid that poles to carry them by seemed superfluous.
Superfluous.
There's not an R. Superfluous. Yeah. I literally said it out loud to myself like four times yesterday because I knew I was not going to be able to pronounce it today. The pitiful shortness of most of them. Sometimes, she continued, they had to put two bodies on the same stretcher. Death had so tightened the final parting embrace. Because of the shortage of ambulances, American Express company trucks were enlisted to transport bodies. As news of the disaster spread rapidly throughout the city, families of Western Electric workers now feared the worst. Young Blanche Homolka and Alice Quinn, whose older sisters had left earlier that morning in high spirits, waited for hours at a streetcar stop, watching as passengers disembarked, their clothing muddy and disheveled. They waited in vain. Caroline Homolka and Anna Quinn were among the dead. As the casualties mounted, the nearby 2nd Regiment Armory was converted to a morgue. Corpses were placed in rows of 85 as the identification process began. Just before midnight, the public was admitted, 20 at a time, to look for family members. The morbidly curious elbowed their way in as well, along with some thieves who stole jewelry from the bodies.
Oh, God.
When Chicagoans woke on Sunday, the magnitude of the disaster was nowhere more apparent than the close-knit Polish, Czech, and Hungarian communities near the Hawthorne Works in Cicero. House after house was draped in black crepe, and families sat in mourning. Just 10 weeks earlier, the Lusitania had been torpedoed and sunk with a death toll of 785 passengers. In 1912, 829 passengers died aboard the Titanic, plus 694 crew members. Both of those disasters took place at the high seas. After the Eastland rolled, 844 passengers died on a sluggish urban river 20 feet from the dock. 75% of them were under the age of 25.
Oh, God.
An estimated 500,000 people arrived to view the disaster scene, crowding into the bridges and the river's edge. Boat owners charged 10 or 15 cents to ferry the curious past. Newspapers around the country gave the story front page coverage for days. On Wednesday, July 28th, Chicago was a city of funerals. So many were scheduled that there were not enough hearses.
Yeah.
Marshall Field & Company provided 39 trucks. 52 gravediggers working 12 hours a day couldn't keep up with the demand. Nearly 150 graves had to be dug at the Bohemian National Cemetery alone. By day's end, almost 700 Eastland victims had been buried. Among them were seven members of the Sindelar family, George, the Western Electric foreman, his wife Josephine, and their five children, ages 15 to 3.
Damn, just the whole family.
Whole family. Josephine.
What do you think that you're doing right now, Miss Ma'am?
Ma'am, you're not long enough. You big idiot.
Look at how spread out her toes are.
I know, she's trying so hard.
Joe, what do you think? for?
Baby Cakes, you are not quite...
He said, Mom, you don't believe in me.
What do you think is up there? Are you gonna do a sit? Oh, she wants your hair tie.
Oh, really? All that effort just for my hair tie?
Oh, girl, you don't know the effort that this girl will go for a hair tie. She has figured out how to open my drawers.
To get hair ties?
To get hair ties out. You're never gonna get it back if you give it
to her. That's okay.
If you toss it, she'll chase it. Dumb idiot. Okay, so the whole family, their white caskets arrived at the service stacked precariously on the back of a Model T Ford. By July 29th, all of the bodies lying in the armory morgue had been claimed except one, a boy identified only as number 396.
Ooh.
Who had been nicknamed Little Feller by police and morgue workers.
Oh wait, no, I can't, hold on, sorry. Ooh, that's going to give me an emotion. Hold on. Let me feel it.
Feel it, acknowledge it, accept it, and let it go.
Let it go. Okay.
Okay. The body was taken to a funeral home where two children recognized him as their friend Willie Novotny, age 7. He had lain unclaimed because his parents, James, the cabinet maker, and his mother, Agnes, had died on the Eastland along with his 9-year-old sister, Mammy. I know. I'm sorry.
Ooh. Oh, God, that is so sad. That poor little one.
I know.
Okay. Sorry, I got my shit together.
All right, I have
here we go.
Approximately 4 more sentences about him.
Okay.
Novotny's grandmother confirmed the identification when she took a pair of brown knickerbockers to the authorities.
What is a knickerbocker?
I think they're pants.
Oh, okay.
If it's Willie, he's got pants like these, she said. It was a new suit he went to the picnic in. 2 pairs of pants came with it, and these are the others. Little Feller now has a name, reported the Chicago Daily Tribune. When the Novotnys were buried on July 31st, more than 5,000 people attended their funeral. The funeral procession stretched for more than a mile.
Oh, I didn't make it through that. Oh, good. Okay.
It's okay. Have the emotions.
You know, I pay good money to not have these.
I don't think that's what Kevin wants.
Is it not?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Okay.
Okay.
Ooh, that is so heckin' sad. That poor grandma was probably absolutely devastated.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely. I can't imagine.
Affixing the blame for the accident began immediately. Eastland Captain Harry Peterson, Chief Engineer Joseph Erickson, and other crew members were taken into custody on Saturday, in part to protect them from the angry crowd that had gathered at the scene. Within 3 days of the accident, 7 inquiries were underway. Cook County officials asserted their jurisdiction immediately. After interviewing witnesses and crew members, County Attorney McClay Hoyne told professors.
Hoyne.
Told reporters, the United States Steamboat Inspection Service is directly responsible for this disaster. Now it is the time to inspect the inspectors. Chicago should demand that and nothing else.
Agreed.
The U.S. Commerce Secretary William C. Redfield, dispatched to Chicago by President Wilson, seized the Eastland, enlisting the help of the U.S. District Judge and future Major League Baseball Commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, in whose courtroom federal proceedings would be heard.
Mm.
Despite the haste, it would take 24 years.
What?
To conclude litigation related to the Eastland disaster.
That is crazy.
Yeah. In the end, blame was pinned largely on Erickson, the chief engineer, for mismanaging the ballast tanks in the hold to right the Eastland before it capsized. Erickson, who initially was represented by Clarence Darrow, died as the proceedings dragged on. That made him, in the view of Hilton, the historian who analyzed the thousands of pages of maritime and legal documents about the Eastland disaster, a convenient fall guy.
Yeah.
Although evidence strongly suggested that Peterson had been negligent, he was not prosecuted, nor were officers of the steamship company. All criminal charges were dropped, and the owners avoided any legal finding of negligence.
Wow.
The blame, Hilton concluded, rested on a poorly designed boat that had been rendered top-heavy as a result of the post-Titanic safety measures. Civil lawsuits to resolve more than 800 wrongful death claims dragged on for 2 decades.
Wow.
Maritime law limited ability to the value of the Eastland, which was set at $46,000. Claims filed by the salvage company hired to tow the vessel from the accident scene and the coal company that supplied fuel took precedence. In the end, victims and families received little or nothing. Ted Wackholtz, president of the Eastland Disaster Historical Society, has a theory on why the Eastland looms so much smaller in American memory than the Titanic or Lusitania. There wasn't anyone rich or famous on board, said Wackholtz. It was all hardworking, salt of the earth, immigrant families.
Oh, that is so fucked.
And that is the USS Eastland disaster.
I hated that. I hated that.
He did it with a
that was
such
so
a passion.
Bad.
I read this article and was immediately like, I could never.
Never do better.
Never do better.
It's so hard to be such like a, you know, middle of the road podcaster in the sea of so many good journalists.
Right. So once again, that was an article for the Smithsonian by Susan Stranahan. And she also has listed her sources. So I'm going to list them as well.
Okay.
So that was The Eastland, The Legacy of the Titanic by George W. Hilton. The Sinking of the Eastland, American's Forgotten Tragedy by Jay Bonasinga. TheEastlandDisaster.org, The Eastland Disaster as a Reporter Saw It, which was in the New York Times, The Experiences of a Hawthorne Nurse by Helen Repa, Western Electric News, The Chicago Daily Journal, Stretchers Made an Endless Chain from the New York Times, ooh, and Little Feller Now Has a Name, which was from the Chicago Daily Tribune.
If anybody ever talks to me about Little Feller again, I'm...
Throw hands.
I'm gonna need to have a small little menti bee.
Menti bee. So, yeah, that was...
Good fucking job.
Yay, Susan.
Yay, so good job, Susan. And good job to you for reading the article. You did a great
Thank
job.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah. And that one's been on the list for a while. And I had told Jenny before I started, this might turn into a little bit of a paranormal.
A little bit of a twofer?
A little bit of a twofer. So I don't know if it'll be enough for our next paranormal episode or if it'll just be in the grab bag, but mm-hmm. I will tell you some of the hauntings that have happened around the Eastland. Oh,
God. Spooky ook. I love it. Good job.
Thank you. What is your bright and shiny?
My bright and shiny is that... I get to hang out on a Sunday with my bestie and record a podcast and laugh about terrible things and cry about terrible things. That's my bright and shiny. What's your bright and shiny?
I love that. My bright and shiny is spring is coming.
Well, are you sure? Because that groundhog fucking kicked the bucket the day before the day it was supposed to do its job.
Yeah, that might be true.
Ian and I have convinced ourselves that it's like a very Game of Thrones kind of thing, where it's like winter forever because Punxsutawney Phillip or whatever his name is died. Uh-huh.
That could be happening. I really hope not, though.
Sorry, I absolutely hijack your bright and shiny. Yes.
No, that's okay.
Spring is coming.
Spring is coming. It is supposed to be like 50 here today. And
what?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
It's supposed to get...
It was like 18 degrees when I left my house this morning.
It's supposed to get warm today.
Say bet.
And tomorrow, I think it is also supposed to be warm. What?
It's going to be 60 degrees on Tuesday.
I know. Tuesday. It's 2/22/2022. Tuesday!
Oh my God. Oh my God. Pluto is returning back. Well, which is not necessarily bad because it is said that it's supposed to, like... Pluto returning to its original aspect, which it was when the United States was
fucked,
created.
Oh.
So Pluto is now, because that was what, 200 something fucking years ago.
Okay.
Pluto is now coming back to the original. Joe, what do you, I've already sacrificed my hair tie to you. What more would you like from me?
She is a goblin.
Yeah, she is. You can have it. I don't care. Anyway.
Sorry.
That it's returning to the same position that it was when the United States was formed. And there were, I think it was a Roman Empire.
Oh.
Rose and fell with Pluto returning back to the same position.
Uh-oh. So are you telling me the United States is about to fall?
No, I'm telling you spring is coming.
Oh, okay. How convenient to tie those two things together.
I'm just saying. 2/22, okay. 2022. It's going to be a magical day. It's going to be 60 degrees here.
I'm excited.
Which is, I'm sorry, I'm learning my Celsius to Fahrenheit conversions right now. I have my fridge. I'm going to say it was on purpose. It's actually like accidentally stuck on Celsius and I don't know how to get it off.
We're using it as a learning.
As a learning tool. Yeah, absolutely.
I like it.
So 60 degrees Fahrenheit is...
Don't eat the microphone. She's such an asshole.
Yo,
come here.
Why are you doing this?
She's like, I can't really decide what I want.
Minus. Is in fact check me on this. I'm gonna say it's gonna be like 2.3. Someone in the UK right now is so fucking pissed off at me, but I swear I'm gonna get it.
What are we looking for?
I am trying to tell you what the temperature is going to be in Celsius when it is gonna be 60 degrees here. And I'm gonna say that it is going to be 28 degrees. No, that is absolutely not correct.
Hold on a second. Okay. What was your guess?
28.
15.
Fuck.
If it was
the math is so hard. My father-in-law was like, well, you know, if 32 is zero in Celsius and it's 2.3 degrees per degree, so all you're going to do is take the temperature that it says and then minus 32 and Eric, multiply by 2. Like, boy, I can't even spell Fahrenheit. You want me to do the math for
We're
it?
We're not doing that.
No, I can't.
No. If it was 28 degrees Celsius, it would be 82 degrees Fahrenheit.
I wish it was 28.
Man. So, follow us on the social meds.
Oh, yeah.
Go
Sorry.
Check us out and join all the things. We would love to have you. You can rate us. You can... Oh, God. She hates it. She hates being held.
Why?
She's... garbage. She's a garbage cat.
She's garbage. She's just fucking garbage.
She's garbage.
Oh my God. Anyway, follow us on the social medias. Follow Taylor on her personal Instagram if you want to see photos of the garbage cat.
Yeah.
And
be kind to yourself.
And to others.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. That got real chaotic at the end there.
I like it.